And arranger, Gonzalo Rubalcaba, bassist Peter Washington, and drummer Kush Abadi. The Biscondi Organ Trio before that, from their album Lockdown, we heard Cannon Road. Guitarist John Ciodini, B3 player Scott Healy, and drummer Kurt Biscera, a group of musicians out of the LA jazz scene. New music just coming out of Washington, D.C. before that, from trombonist Ben Patterson. His composition called This Is What I'm Doing, from his new album on Origin Records called Stretch. And that group brings together guitarist Sean Purcell, pianist Harry Appleman, bassist Miles Brown, and drummer Todd Harrison. And the set started with music from Australian singer Nikki Parrott. Off of her album Feeling Groovy, we heard These Boots Are Made for Walking. Martha Bartz doing the work on the tenor. If you want to get in touch, check out the contact page on the show's website for email and social media links. That's going to be a wrap for this week. Look for a link to this week's podcast from our Mixcloud channel, along with playlist information, on the show's website, jazzboulevard.ca. You've been listening to Jazz Boulevard, syndicated radio. This is Moz Taylor, signing off now and inviting you to join me next week for our next program. Hope you enjoyed the music on this week's show. Thanks for tuning in.
Comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and CFRC's Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Ara McCauley, covering an update on Kingston's Crossroads Village Cabins.
Hello, I'm Ara McCauley, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach out to our news team at news@cfrc.ca. Following up on a story CFRC reported on last week, City Council voted unanimously in favor of a motion by Councillor Ridge to extend the timeline for Our Livable Solutions to submit a funded proposal for the Crossroads Village Sleeping Cabin Project at June 16th Council meeting. With the original deadline set to elapse in a matter of weeks, the motion extends OLS's time by an additional 13 months to July 31st, 2027. The extension is intended to allow OLS sufficient time to finalize their operational plan for the village site. Jan English, an alumni of the original Sleeping Cabin project, appeared as a delegate to speak to council ahead of their decision.
Good evening, Your Worship, council members. I'm here tonight to ask for an extension on the June 30th deadline for the cabin community to be placed at Crossroads Church. We're all here tonight because OLS has helped us in so many ways, but it's not just an organization. It's something that brings your life back. When I came to stay at the cabin community, I had been on the road for 4 years roughly, and I was at the end of my rope. It brought back my life. They respect the people that come through the door. Each and every one of us has different backgrounds. We all have different issues. They didn't treat us like we were all in one basket. They listened to what we had to say. They worked with our strengths, our weaknesses, and we became a family. It runs on many different aspects that makes it work. I can't say strongly enough that each and every one of us here has benefited hugely from that organization. When you're out there, you lose your dignity, your self-respect, everything. You become broken. It builds us back up. It made us a family. These aren't just people that I lived with in the cabin community. They're my family now. It's a very important service, and as far as I'm concerned, it's the only one out there that works. Anything you want to better yourself, they'll help you get it. They don't just work with you until you leave the community. They still help me now, and I'm housed. They still give me support. They're there if I call, if I have a question, something I need to have information on. They're still very much a part of my life. It's a very important organization, and I can't say how strongly I feel about this. All we can ask is that you please extend the deadline so it can continue.
The council motion recognized the work OLS has done to date, citing the line of credit the group has secured, commitments from private donors, and advancing negotiations with a provincial entity for a social enterprise. It also acknowledged that extending the timeline supports the city's commitment to increasing housing stability and reducing homelessness in Kingston. The motion also directed staff to hold off on any plans to sell the 17 cabins the city has had in storage until after the new July 31st, 2027 extension had passed, and allows OLS representatives to view the sleeping cabins to assess their condition. Acting Executive Director Crystal Wilson had previously told CFRC that the whereabouts and condition of the cabins had not been disclosed to them since the conclusion of their pilot project.
I think that it's only fair that OLS have the opportunity to assess the conditions of the cabins as part of their planning for the preparation of Crossroad Village. But simultaneously, if the city are to take the cabins as an asset, we also need to know the condition regardless. And so that I think that it's important in terms of prudence and also kindness to OLS to move forward with that.
OLS reached out to council to request this extension to finalize their operational plan and complete necessary planning and development steps prior to submitting a funded proposal. The vote, which came at the tail end of a 4.5-hour council meeting, passed without questions or comments from council members. CFRC spoke with Crystal Wilson about council's decision and what the next steps are for Crossroads Village.
First of all, I wanted to congratulate you on succeeding with the extension. So this gives you until the end of July of 2027 now. How are you feeling about this decision?
Well, I'm glad council supported. I think, you know, it's a really good program, and Jan English and a number of alumni came to support the delegation, and Jan did a fantastic job. And, you know, we continually go back to people who've stayed in the program and in the cabins and say, should we keep pursuing? Is there a better alternative at this point? Should we keep pursuing, and or should we just move on and try something else? And they keep telling us to keep pushing for it, that the cabins work for them. It's not just the cabins. It's not the physical structure. It's the program that we offer within them. And a number of them keep saying that they want their cabins back. What they're saying and what they miss is the community. And, you know, we do our best to support people once they're housed. But what they're missing is having people there when they're struggling. They can walk outside their cabin door and find support right away, you know, participate in activities with other people. And once you go to permanent housing, your own apartment, you have to create a whole new network. They miss that support and sense of community.
Well, maybe Chrissy was saying an opportunity to volunteer at the new cabins.
Yeah, or work too. We had a number of people that were residents of the cabin program trained to come back once they were housed as staff. The opportunity is still there. They still retain the training. So we're hoping that a number of our alumni will be able to come back as staff.
When we spoke last, there was a hope this could get going in a matter of months. Does this slow down progress? Does it keep going forward as it was?
It certainly wouldn't slow down progress. It gives us takes some pressure off and gives us some time to, when we make decisions at the board level, we've been having lots of discussions about whether and when to spend money and whether it's fiscally responsible to be spending money on Crossroads. If we hadn't got the extension and the deadline hit, we've spent money on trying to get Crossroads open, right? And is that responsible? It's people's money. We don't want to be irresponsible with donations. So we've had lots of conversations. Like, do we do this? We don't do this. Do we keep pushing forward? And do we spend the money that in the original motion, the city had committed $150,000 towards pre-construction, getting through the planning process and purchasing the 18th cabin? Well, we've done that now with help from the Davies Foundation and other donors because we needed those things to be able to move forward. And so the city has said that they will consider reimbursing expenses that we've put towards pre-construction when, we finally get to an agreement. Last week was a whirlwind. We had a number of people reach out for support. So we have the support of a digital marketing company now, who's going to help us with explaining to the public what we do because we spend our time with people. We don't spend a whole lot of time on marketing. We don't spend any money on marketing. We invest in the people. And so the challenge is that the public doesn't have as much awareness of what we do. So this company has stepped up and said that they'll help us out with fixing that challenge. And we did secure a line of credit for $700,000 at 2% interest. We're not intending on running Crossroads Village on a line of credit. It's just there to provide some buffer in case money is coming, but we don't have it yet. It's just to help secure our financial stability. We received funding from the Davies Foundation last week, $20,000 to retrofit the cabins with a different kind of heating cooling system. When the cabins were open, we just had portable AC units like window shakers and portable heaters. This way, we can install them right into the cabins. And so we don't have to seasonally remove them and swap them out. Gives more space for residents inside their cabin because they'll be installed in the walls. So they'll have more floor space.
And speaking of the cabins, part of the motion was to allow you to see the cabins. Are you excited? Are you nervous about seeing them?
Honestly, I'm not sure what to think. We have no knowledge of where the cabins are being stored or how they're being stored. And when we talked to counselors, we said we'd really like an opportunity to check on them to make sure that they're still secure and safe and usable. The cabins are very tightly built for air leaks. They're built for the Arctic. So all of the corners and the seams are epoxied together and have a special join to make sure there's no air leaks. So they've been sealed up for 2 years. So we're a little concerned about organic material. People were in the cabin. So does that mean mold? Were they properly handled being moved to wherever the storage location is? We want to make sure they're in good shape while we keep fighting for them.
There was a conversation last night about the integrated care hub, and there was a proposal by one of the counselors talking about different ways of doing things, and he was referencing models in other countries, and it wasn't accepted.
I've done some investigating into what Councillor McLaren has been expressing support for in terms of what Finland did. I've worked with him on interviewing people in need of housing to develop a plan, a Kingston strategy for supporting people out of homelessness. And I'm an entrepreneur, so I believe in what he was expressing. I'm not sure if you don't have an entrepreneurial mindset, maybe it was harder to understand, but it's how OLS operates. We listen to people that are living the challenges and then we respond. I do a lot of expressing of like, we're just the administrative minions. And the people that we support are the ones who guide us and show us the way forward. And so OLS, in response to safety emergencies on the street, in January, we launched an initiative to get 100 people trained in first aid, people with lived and living experience. And then the announcement of the CTS closing
Consumption and Treatment Services.
came, and so we pushed up our deadline. So we were aiming for 100 people by the end of December, and so now we've pushed up our deadline to be the end of September so that we have 100 people out there trained in first aid so they can identify medical emergencies and then also respond until emergency services can get on site. We're hoping that effort also alleviates some pressure on emergency services and unfortunately the coroner as well. So that entrepreneurial thinking and what Mr. McLaren was describing is how OLS operates. We also, you know, identified communication is a big challenge. People with limited incomes are very hesitant to pay for cell phone plans. And, you know, even if they can get a cell phone, they're usually operating on Wi-Fi. But as soon as they're away from certain buildings, they have no connection. So we're developing a mesh core communication network that works off grid and it runs on radio frequencies. So people will be able to communicate by text. We're working right now with a team of people to get the network stable and coverage across the whole city. So thankfully, some churches have agreed to participate with us. Getting the repeaters, they're called, up on their spires will help with that coverage and help with that reliability. We're pretty excited. We're hoping by the end of the summer we'll have a pretty solid network, and our estimated cost for developing this network is only $2,700 to build a communication network that's off-grid. So when the power goes out and nobody else can use their cell phones, we'll still be able to communicate. But it means that we'll be able to reach the people that we support, and we'll be able to keep track of our street outreach team, which is a concern. As when we were developing and plan with the people on our team, one of the things they said is they want us to be able to find them if, you know, something could happen.
So a lot of exciting projects underway, a lot of exciting opportunities on the horizon. What are the next steps for you?
I have to send out a whole bunch of emails today. Of like, because we're all sitting on pause waiting, like, should we proceed, not proceed? We're not sure, like, you know, are we going to hit this deadline and be done, or are we going to be able to get past it? So I have a lot of emails to send out saying, okay, we're going ahead. Our next step in terms of Crossroads pre-construction planning is a wastewater study. So we gave the engineer we work with a go ahead for that last night. And then the marketing team that has offered support, that's our my next email, is to say, okay, we're good. And then continuing to look for opportunities. We're working on a social enterprise that will hopefully generate both jobs and funding for Crossroads Village. You know, we're working forward with it, but we couldn't get it completed by the June 30th deadline. So we're hoping that that proceeds and we can maybe launch it in the fall. And then looking for opportunities to keep providing support for the people we support, but also finding ways to generate the funding from within our organization.
And I would imagine, despite this extension, you're still open to ideas from the community, partnerships, sponsorships. If you can just reiterate, how do people reach out to you if they want to support this initiative, help you get Crossroads Village up and running well before the extension deadline?
Before winter would be amazing. Our website is ourlivable.solutions, and then our email address is info@ourlivable.solutions as well. We can be found on Facebook, and our phone number is 613-383-2292. So feel free to reach out. Any questions at all, any ideas at all. This is really truly a community effort. So if more community members can help us figure this out, that would be amazing.
Well, I know you have a busy time ahead, so I will leave it there, but thank you so much. I'm really happy that this is the conversation that we got to have.
Thank you for your support too.
Thank you, Era. Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen reading a story from the local journalism initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about a proposed $2.1 million increase for a water infrastructure project in the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Jesse. A proposed $2.1 million increase for a major water infrastructure project, a bridge rehabilitation contract, and measures to address a nearly $590,000 operating deficit are among the key items facing Leeds and Thousand Islands Council next week. Council's agenda includes a recommendation to add $2.1 million to the budget for the township's water storage and booster pumping station project and authorize staff to obtain construction debt to finance the work. If the measure is approved, Dalkin Constructors Limited will be awarded the contract for the project at a cost of $6.6 million, inclusive of net HST. Council will also consider awarding a $367,000 contract to G. Tackaberry & Sons Construction Company Limited for the rehabilitation of the Black Rapids Road Bridge. Staff recommend an additional $111,000 be added to the project's capital budget, with the money coming from the bridge reserve. Council is being asked to approve the township's 2025 audited financial statements and transfer a total of $588,421 from reserve funds to cover the year's deficit. The recommendation calls for $441,316 to come from the Working Fund Reserve and $147,105 from the Contingency Reserve. Members will also review a proposed capital carry-forward budget of $1.8 million in tax-supported projects and $3.1 million in water and wastewater projects. Planning matters include zoning bylaw amendments for properties at One Lone Tree Island and 161 and 164 Ivy Lee Road, as well as a request to remove holding provisions from lands at 151 Fitzsimmons Road. Council is also expected to approve community improvement plan grants totaling nearly $11,000 for properties at 239 Back Street and 436 Lyndhurst Road. Other items on the agenda include the appointment of Councillor Todd Robertson of Leeds County OPP Detachment Board for the remainder of the current term, bylaws dealing with lame duck council restrictions, and the 2026 Municipal Election Compliance Audit Committee, and a proposal to install a memorial bench honoring Dr. Briggs at Sealy's Bay Harbor.
Thank you to Dinah Jansen and Keith Dempsey for that story. Coming up next, I've got your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your CFRC Power Plays Sports Report. And I'm joined in studio today by two Olympic hopefuls, James Fair and Alex McDonald. James, Alex, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
If you wouldn't mind just giving the folks at home a quick introduction to who you are and what the Olympic dream is looking like.
Yeah, so my name is James Fair. I'm from Kingston, Ontario originally. I'm also a Queen's student at Queen's University studying mechanical engineering. I've been sailing my whole life. I started at the Kingston Yacht Club when I was around 4 or 5 years old, began racing when I was 8, all the way up to the national team level, and then I started shooting for the Olympic dream just in the last couple of years.
And I am originally from Australia, you might be able to tell by my accent. And I learned to sail when I was a kid and coached a little bit, but it wasn't my primary sport. I was a rower for most of high school and the beginning of university. I started uni in Australia, and then I actually transferred to Queen's halfway through my degree. So I'm a dual Canadian and Australian citizen. And then I met James about a year ago, and he introduced me to sailing at this sort of level, and we had 3 weeks of intense training, and we went for our first regatta, and it's kind of sprung from there.
One of the big things we've picked up on is this connection kind of from a younger age with the water, with sailing. Was it something that came from the parents? Was there always kind of a natural attraction for it? I guess the big question is, what drew you guys to the world of sailing?
For me, it was definitely my dad. So my dad is an avid sailor since he was pretty young as well. He's podiumed at world championships multiple times. And so I've always had him as a coach and a supporter throughout my life and to look up to.
Yeah, and for myself, growing up on the water and doing numerous different water sports, I just love being out there. And coming from a rowing background, where you're really pushing yourself hard and, you know, striving for an ambitious goal, you know, what better goal to push myself towards?
Can you talk a little bit about the mixed 470 sailing class in general? Because certainly I'm no sailing expert, and I think it's a sport that maybe a lot of our listeners are not super familiar with. So can you give us a quick rundown of mixed 470 and maybe talk about why you guys may in fact be the first Canadians to qualify?
Absolutely. So the mixed 470 class, in the name, you can see it's mixed, so that means one male, one female. So it's a two-person boat. The boat has been in the Olympics since the 76 Olympics when it was first hosted in Kingston. But the mixed 470 class, it's a new change since the Tokyo Olympics, where they've switched from a separate male and female category over to the mixed category.
Yeah, and then I think in Canada, there's, you know, only a handful of teams at the moment. So, we're hoping to be the... Sorry. I'll just take a minute.
Sorry. Yeah, all good.
In Canada, there's only a couple of teams, and we haven't had a boat go to the Olympics for Canada in the mixed 470. So if we make it, we would be the first.
Now that we've kind of set the stage, we've talked about the background, we've talked about the new changes to the event,
How can our listeners at home help support this Olympic dream?
So there's many ways. Firstly would be, you know, following us on our social media and keeping up to date with what we're doing. Our Instagram is TeamCanada470. And then next would be our fundraiser. So we have a really exciting fundraiser on the 26th of June that we've planned at the Kingston Yacht Club. There's going to be lots of exciting things, auctions, raffles, music, food and drinks. So yeah, to come along would be the best way.
And yeah, so that event's going to be running from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's free admission. And anybody who comes, we recommend a donation of $20 to $25, but anybody's welcome to join, and we're just happy to have people there.
100%. And I love that very accessible number, that $20 to $25, because I think, especially when it comes to sailing, maybe a sport people aren't familiar with, they don't really know what that cost point could look like. But by encouraging, yeah, those smaller entry-level donations, I think that's a great way to not just work towards the goal, but foster a sense of community, because what you're looking to do is a pretty profound thing. You are looking to represent an entire country, and I think that's a really beautiful goal to strive for. And for our podcast listeners, we will have a link to that event in the description. For our radio listeners, I'm just going to reiterate. So it's the social media account one more time.
It's TeamCanada470 at Instagram.
And I'm assuming you'll be posting more event details closer to the date. And it's June 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Kingston Yacht Club. It's an event with local connections, a Kingston and Queens connection that is looking to power a couple of young athletes all the way to the 2028 Summer Games. James, Alex, thank you very much for your time. All the best. I am looking forward to following the ongoing accomplishments of Team Canada, and a pretty historic thing here. We really appreciate you giving some time to CFRC to amplify your dream, your goals, and we've got our fingers crossed. We'll be making a donation. We wish you all the best.
Of course. Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jesse, for that update, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, June 23rd, rainy day here in the city of Kingston with a high of 21 that felt closer to 24, dropping down to 14 overnight. Wednesday, June 24th, 21 is your high with a 55% chance of rain in the afternoon. Otherwise, it'll be a sunny, beautiful day, dropping down to 16 overnight. Thursday, June 25th, 21 is your high with a 60% chance of rain in the forecast, down to 15 overnight. Friday, June 26th, 21 is your high, but with a 75% chance of rain throughout the day. Otherwise, a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 14 overnight. For the final weekend in June, kicks off with a rainy day on Saturday, June 27th, high of 22, 77% chance of rain, down to 14 overnight. Sunday, June 28th, finally a beautiful sunny day. 23 is your high, feeling closer to 26 with an overnight low of 15. And then kicking off the start of next week, a little bit more rain in the forecast. Monday, June 29th, 23 is your high with a 55% chance of precipitation. That's a wrap for your weather report. Over now to Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny. And this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, community events, workshops, markets, art exhibits, or something fun to do around the city, there is plenty of happening in Kingston this week, so let's get into it. On Wednesday, the Biosciences Complex hosts the Preferred Supplier Trade Show from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., while Thrive 365 presents Watercolor Flow, Finding Motivation and Connection in McIntosh Quarry Hall. Teens can head to Rideau Heights Branch for games and grub later in the afternoon. In the evening, you'll find plenty of ways to get involved around the city, including board game night at the Legion, karaoke at Time Out Bar, music trivia at Riverhead Brewing, and Euchre Night at La Vida Briefstro. Live music includes Carson Cameron at Bank Gastro Bar, Sean McCollin at the Cove Inn, Ruben DeGroot as part of the Soundwaves concert series at Spicer's Dockside Grill, and open mic night at Hotel Wolf Island. Thursday starts with the Kingston Public Market in Springer Market Square running throughout the day. The Central Branch Library hosts 20-something Thursday trivia night in the evening, while Cruise for a Cause sets sail from Crawford Wharf. Queen's University's Thrive 365 series also presents Culture in Action, Storytelling, Anxiety, and Resilience with acclaimed author David A. Robinson. Music highlights include Lotus White at the Cove Inn, J.S. Miller on the Helm Dockside Patio, Ted Lalonde at the Time Out Bar, Beats Working at the RCHA Club, and the Good Brothers at the Broom Factory. Friday brings a packed lineup of arts, music, and community events. Cultivate Arts Common hosts meditation in the gallery with Jay Vidarthi in the morning, while the Isabel Turner Branch celebrates summer with the library after hours kickoff party for teens. The Tet Center also welcomes artist in residence Jarena Lee for a studio exhibition and artist talk. Music fans can check out the opening day of the Power of Positivity Music Festival at Line Spike Frontenac, while DevFest 2026 gets underway featuring artists including The Trues, The Strumbellas. Other highlights include Elvis Returns at The Sphere, Christopher Jackson at The Caesar Company, Big Smoke Brass at the RCHA Club, and Guilty Pleasures at Time Out Bar. Heading into Saturday, there is no shortage of things to do. The Kingston Public Market returns downtown, while the Charbot Lake Farmers Market and Live at the Library featuring Zoo Crew offer family-friendly options. Pride Month celebrations continue with Books and Beans at the Central Branch Library, and the Tet Center hosts its art-making workshop, Your Mark Echoing from Within. Music highlights include two of the Power Positivity Music Festivals featuring Casador, Harm and Ease, and Will and Company, as well as DevFest 2026. You can also catch the BJX Bon Jovi experience at the Sphere, Long Range Hustle and Matt Basnett at the Broom Factory, the Big Fat Horn Band at the RCHA Club, and Ave of Wands at Hotel Wolf Island. Wrapping things up Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market returns from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., while the Cataraqui Indigenous Market takes place at Confederation Park. If you're looking for something a little different, Puppies and Jazz combine adorable dogs and live music at the Caesar Company. Music lovers can enjoy the final day of the Power Positivity Festival featuring Rain Madda and Miss Emily. Head over heels at the Cove Inn and live music Sundays at Finkel Shore Park. That's your weekly events and concerts calendar for June 22nd through the 28th. For more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This events calendar is brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their upcoming shows and events throughout the season. I'm Jenny, and thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times.
Hello, and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are currently working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Paul Akpomoje, who's working on a PhD in education under the supervision of Dr. Claire Ahn. Welcome to GradChat, Paul.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming. And before we dive into your research topic today, I was curious to know a little bit about what attracted you to Queen's for your graduate research in the first place?
That's a good question. I get to be asked that question oftentimes. As a matter of fact, I remember when I was applying to come to Queen's and I had the first meeting with my amiable supervisor. That was the question she asked me. She was like, "So Paul, why are you interested in Queen's? Why do you want to come to Queen's?" I remember what I said then is what I am saying now. And that is the social justice component, you know, that the Faculty of Education has. The Faculty of Education is very, I would say, we have this set of faculty members who are very grounded in social justice research. And because I am very much interested in social justice research, I was like, it has to be Queen's and it has to be the Faculty of Education. So I would say that the social justice component of the PhD education program there, it was a big attraction.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that the original attraction has continued throughout your research and been confirmed that you made the right choice for conducting your research at the Faculty of Ed. And with that, can you tell us a little bit about what your research topic is for your PhD?
That's a really good question. Oftentimes when people ask me what your research topic is, I get sometimes confused because there are many parts to it. But just to put it as it is, it is visa stories of Nigerian immigrants in Canada and implication on their identities. But in a very lay way, I try to describe my research topic as visa stories and the poetics of migration. Because there is that synergy between those two, you know, elements. So, yeah.
Very nice. Okay, so it sounds like that could be very, very broad. It could encompass a lot. So is there like a particular community within Nigerian immigrants in Canada that you speak with or work with? Or can you tell us about a little bit about who you're working with, I guess?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that follow-up question. I was really hopeful that you would ask because that gives me an opportunity to clarify. I'm specifically working with migrant doctoral students. And very also specifically at Queen's University.
Okay.
So my research participants are PhD students who are at Queen's, who are in their first year and above. So that's the specific group of Nigerian migrants or immigrants in Canada that I'm working with. And this is, I have a couple of reasons why I'm working with this particular group. And this is because I was drawn to those specific migration experiences that he had with respect to being in a higher education program at Queen's at a higher level, that's at a PhD level. Yeah, so that specific set of people is the group of people I'm working with.
Okay, and how do you approach that? Like, what methodology are you working with, or methodologies are you working with to learn about what the experiences of Nigerian doctoral students at Queen's and...
Yeah, that's a really lovely question, because I would say that my methodology is everything about my research. And I'm very thankful to my supervisor, Dr. Claire Ahn, who is an expert in multimodality and multiliteracies. So when I was coming to Queen's and I was thinking of, okay, what methodology do I use to do this research? I remember my supervisor and I, we had a lot of ideas and conversations about what do we do differently. I wanted to do something that I would say is different. That doesn't mean that people haven't done it, but in my own little world, I would say something different. And so what that means is that I was thinking about, okay, how do I approach this? Including thinking about, oh, okay, podcast and media, what do I do? So eventually, because also I am somebody who is interested in poetry, I was thinking, okay, why don't I think about a non-traditional way of doing narrative research, right? Narrative research and narrative methodology, I would say, is very Western-centric. It's very Eurocentric. I think about the way narrative research done across the world is very centered on Eurocentric ways of being and knowing, of doing research. And I was like, okay, how do I bring in African, you know, approach to this thing? And that's the orality. You know, that, how do we bring in that oral component of doing narrative research that also centers, you know, African voices, and also centers, you know, voices that are often, you know, silent. So that drew me to thinking about multimodality, and so the methodology that I'm using is because I'm done with data collection.
Oh, congratulations!
The methodology that I use for my data collection was grounded in that multimodal, you know, approach, where I was engaging with my participants with different genres. For example, we're using what I call mockumentary, pretty much like a short episodic, you know, comedy series, to sort of like get them to be to awaken their consciousness. That's the word I'm looking for. So we use that comedy series, for example, to awaken consciousness of participants about, you know, visa experiences, about migration experiences. Then we also went on to use music. You know, we also went on to use nonfiction, like short nonfiction pieces. And I really like this particular one that I use, and I know it might be of interest to the radio audience. And that's the one by Elamine Abdelmahmoud.
Okay, yes.
The Son of Elsewhere. I remember my supervisor, you know, told me, I said, Paul, have you read this book, Son of Elsewhere? I said, oh, I'd like to. And that became one of the materials that I used in my research, you know, by, you know, asking my participants to read certain pieces of that story. And what they read triggered them, you know, to begin to, you know, think about their own experience. You know, so that was also something else. And we also used poetry. And I'm so grateful to one of my mentors, that's Juliana Okot-Bitek, who's a professor in English department. I used one of her poems as well, which is There Is Something About Vancouver. That's an amazing poem. So that's another piece of poetry that I also used in my research. So these different modes, from poetry to written nonfiction to movies, that which is like a comedy series, which it's more like a mockumentary series, you know, even to use a newspaper article. So these are like different pieces of instruments that I use to awaken the consciousness of my participants. So I didn't have to do so much in terms of questioning them. They just needed to engage those pieces, and then they were like, oh my goodness, this is me. You know, they were seeing themselves in those, you know, stories.
The resonation of,
exactly. So those were some of the things. And then I went on to also do, by the way, I did all of those in workshop settings,
okay,
right?
With
so
groups,
specifically,
yes.
I used workshop and interviews. So all of those multimodal pieces, I use them within the workshop setting, and even the traditional, like newspaper articles and even nonfiction, those were done within workshop settings. So I invited my participants to different workshops, specifically 4 workshops. You know, they also created their own story of migrancy, and they used different modes. Some of them used music, some of them used poetry, some of them used, you know, what I call think piece, to also tell their own stories. So those were the ways I gathered my data. And then I did a one-on-one follow-up interview with the participants, you know, on a one-on-one basis. That's pretty much what I would say for now.
Oh, that is wonderful. So it sounds like, again, I'm not an education scholar, but it sounds like you infused traditional Western practices with a different epistemological approach to thinking about how to create new ways of mm-hmm. doing things and not being bound by traditional research on narrative and looking outside of just a Western canon to see what could be done to help understand and appreciate the experiences of Nigerian PhD students, and then to allow them to also reflect and create their own new. Mm-hmm. There's so many things. I don't think media quite captures it, but their own artistic expressions, right, or different types of expressions of experience. Would that be fair to say?
That's close to read. But I wouldn't even say traditional Western, you know, methodology.
Okay.
What I did was to do away with the traditional
Western. Get rid of it completely. Yeah. Yes.
Was to say, because I did mention the piece about orality. Mm-hmm. You know, orality is a very, you know, very strong African indigenous mm-hmm. method, right? So that way people's voices are centered. Mm-hmm. So my approach was to, how do I center the voices of my participant? Mm-hmm. So how do I make the research, you know, focused or centered on the participant and not on me? Yeah, mm-hmm. right. So mm-hmm. I was sort of like decentered, and mm-hmm. the participants were centered in their research because it's their story, it's their lived experiences. Mm-hmm. So that my methodology sort of put them at the center of the research, mm-hmm. Where they took, you know, ownership of their own voices. They took ownership of, you know, the way they wanted to share or tell their stories, and that's the important piece, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how I would describe it.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so, in a traditional Western sense, the researcher might be observing folks, whereas in yours, the participants are creating and at the center of it, and you're facilitating but not directing curate, like you're creating space for it.
I was pretty much curating that mm-hmm. space for the participants to tell their stories mm-hmm. and not imposing anything, and not just also observing what they are not saying mm-hmm. and saying that they said, you know, which is the, you know, as you said, traditional mm-hmm. Western way of reason, you know. So yeah, so mm-hmm. I curated the space for participants to, you know, tell their story. I would say it was pretty much organizing a community mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. people to tell their stories.
Yeah.
And I think that's the word, because I'm using this word specifically because some of my participants did use that word. Mm. That your research gave us community.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So that community was a very strong component mm-hmm. of the research, where participants, you know, felt that they had just gone through, you know, what I would call therapy. Mm. You know, as a matter of fact, some participants described the entire research process as therapeutic.
Wow. Yeah. So the impact is huge.
The impact is huge.
Wow. Yeah. So I think you've alluded to this already, but what is the impact and why is this research so crucial, especially right now in kind of this global context of restricted mobility and shifting attitudes towards migration and mobility? So why is this so important right now?
That's a great question. I don't think that the world has faced a more difficult time when it comes to global mobility, with what is happening in the US, you know, with what is happening in some parts of Europe, with what is happening in Canada today, the mm-hmm. politicization of immigration. I would think that immigration is something that is crucial, but this is not to also lose sight of the fact that Canada is built, I don't want to say Canada is not built on migration. Canada is built on settler colonialism. Mm-hmm. And we have to continue to recognize the fact that people belong to this land originally. The mm-hmm. indigenous people belong to this land originally. And they were displaced, I would say. Many mm-hmm. of them, you know, were, you know, removed from mm-hmm. their lands. And mm-hmm. the lands were taken from them by, you know, European settlers. And I would say that we have to continue to talk about that. We have to continue to say that we have to continue to talk about decolonization. Mm-hmm. We have to continue to talk about all of those very important social justice movement that we have to continue to talk about. But even then, historically, Africans were also brought to this land to mm-hmm. build this land. And as laborers, as mm-hmm. cheap laborers, you know, maybe they were not even paid, if you like. But the point I want to bring out of this is that there is this historical, you know, element about movement and mobility, starting from when it was, you know, people coming to grab lands that didn't belong to them, to these same people bringing in, you know, Africans to come and, you know, build mm-hmm. this country. That's a history we have to continue to bring to, you know, to fore mm-hmm. so that we can continue to. But then, when people then want to come to Canada, and I have to say this also, bringing people to Canada, like opening the borders and say, oh, migration, people come, mm-hmm. it's definitely also, you know, a way of perpetuating certain logics, mm. you know, logics mm-hmm. of control, logics of, you know, wealth creation, economics and whatnot, you know. However, there is a global concern about how migration is racialized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is the point here. How certain bodies are not allowed, you know, to go through the borders
mm-hmm.
versus how it is so easy for certain bodies to go through the borders. You know, and that's the peak, you know, of my argument mm. in terms of how do we make the migration experience to be centered on humanity rather than on the color of skin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where my research comes in terms of how do we undo
mm.
practices of migration that perpetuates harm, mm. that perpetuates different forms, you know, of discrimination and stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something that is crucial in this conversation. And so why my research is important is, in this sense, is that if Canada is opening its borders to migrant students to come in, how are migrant students experiencing space?
Mm-hmm.
How is this experience also informing the way they think about themselves? How is this impacting their identity? How is this shaping their, you know, their worldviews and whatnot? So I think that the research such as mine, mm-hmm. and I would say that there are people doing, you know, other research.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is just unique specifically because of the methodology, the mm-hmm. approach with which I'm doing this research. And, you know, with also with respect to the specific context, mm-hmm. right? How do we rethink migration policies and practices mm-hmm. in ways that are centered on decolonization,
mm.
in ways that are centered on humanity, in ways that are centered on, you know, equity
mm-hmm.
and, you know, social justice. And that's really the point,
mm-hmm.
you know, such that people are not treated specifically on the basis of who they are.
Mm.
Because they identify as Black or they identify as African, they should not necessarily be, you know, mistreated. Let me mm-hmm. use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because of how they identify. And this is not just, I have to put this very front and forward,
mm-hmm.
this is not just migration in terms of the paperwork of migration. The paperwork of migration is important. It's mm-hmm. an important component of my research. But it's not just about the paperwork of visas, mm-hmm. of get visas. So when I say visa stories,
mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily mean, you know, the visa that is stamped on the booklet.
It's a little deeper than that.
It's a lot deeper than that.
Yes, yes.
It is visa stories that mm-hmm. goes into space
mm-hmm.
and place and, you know, experiences within different social contexts mm-hmm. in Canada. Experiences in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Experiences, just an experience that a person would have by just being, you know, at Kingston Center.
Mm-hmm.
Or an experience that a person would have by being on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those experiences put together is what I have operationalized
mm.
as visa stories.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. not necessarily the paperwork of visa, which is a crucial part of mm-hmm. it, but that is not the only, you know, angle, the only lens from which I'm looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in other words, there are these different pieces
mm-hmm.
that add up to the visa stories that I'm exploring.
It sounds like, again, and correct my understanding mm-hmm. if needed, but you're looking at these long histories of migration and settlement in what is now known as Canada
mm-hmm.
and seeing how maybe logics of racial discrimination are being reproduced and mm-hmm. re-experienced and saying, you know, if Canada is supposed to have one idea of like a mythical idea of nationhood,
mm-hmm.
where are people being excluded from that and how can we understand experiences of, in this case specifically, Nigerian doctoral students to understand where harms are being perpetrated and how we can maybe remedy that as a nation, but understanding that it fits into this long, long story and long history mm-hmm. of different types of migration and understanding that it's a settler colonial foundation from mm-hmm. which it comes from, and then pushing that to the current and seeing what that looks like now and how it's being experienced for newcomers to the area.
I wouldn't say that that historical piece is big on my work because there's a recognition.
Exactly, yes, you're aware of
there's a recognition of that history of settler colonialism. And I have to say this, that the same logic of settler colonialism that, you know, that was used to grab lands from people here, which we have to continue to talk about and speak against, there's a similar logic of post-colonialism in Nigeria. There's a similar logic of post-colonial struggles that are going on, you know, in Nigeria that impels people to travel. You know, there are neo-colonial tendencies about, you know, how the economics of certain countries are controlled by global power, you know, by this, you know, global control of, you know, wealth and whatnot, you know, that continues to reproduce, you know, certain forms of hardship in those countries, you know, such as Nigeria. And people then say, okay, I have to leave to find, you know, better life for myself and my family and my kids, you know. And then one of the ways people are living is, okay, let me go and further my education somewhere. You know, so there is that connection.
There's an entanglement.
There's an entanglement, you know, there. And that doesn't also mean that, you know, the colonial, you know, experience of indigenous people here is over. It's still ongoing. It's an ongoing practice. And it's ongoing, and we have to continue to, you know, speak against it and decolonize the system. You know, so, but for specifically saying for my research is how are those, as you said, how are those logics surfacing with new faces of discrimination, of racialization, specifically against Nigerian PhD students at Queen's. And this is because this is the specific group of students that I'm working with. So, yes, you're right. There is a resurface of these racialization. There is a resurface of these, you know, acts of discrimination that we have to, you know, engage.
And it sounds like, well, from the response you had from your participants in finding community, that it can really, this new methodological approach can really help people address these concerns, like address the harms and put them in context with and put them in relation with one another and bring them together. And you said that, and you were using mockumentary and poetry and nonfiction and newspaper articles and different things to try and bring this to the fore for people and to allow them to reflect alongside, you know, a piece of artistic work to bring out their own experiences.
Correct.
And that you've used poetry for this and you use poetry outside of your academic work as well. So alongside your academic writing, you are also a poet and writing poetry. And you have, I hear, a forthcoming collection coming out on African migration. And that sounds like a lot to manage between doing working on a dissertation and working on a collection of poetry. So how did you manage the workload of these two very intense projects at once?
That's a really good question. Again, you know, in the real sense of it, a good question. Poetry for me is life. And poetry is a way of being. I would say that as a poet, and having done some poetry community events within Queens, you know, and Kingston, with special gratitude to my mentor, Dr. Catherine McKittrick, who, you know, who supported me and mentored me, you know, towards doing some of these things that I do, especially having organized the Poetics of Migration in 2024. January 2024, which was a very major poetry event in Kingston.
I do remember seeing this. Exactly. It was very major.
It was a major one, right? That, you know, that we did somewhere at Pedal Works Cafe. Those were like the blocks that shaped my work. And those are like the blocks that got me thinking about what I need to do. So when I started documenting my experiences, really my forthcoming poetry book is really a memoir. That's why I describe it. It's a memoir of my own experiences of being a migrant graduate student here, at Queens. Mm-hmm. You know, if I go to class and something happens in class, I come home and I write a poem about it. Mm-hmm. If I, if something happens to my kids at school, they come home, they tell me this happened, I write a poem about it. So it was like a memoir. It was a way to document. Mm. So that's why I would say it wasn't so much of a burden. I was only documenting my day-to-day experiences, of my lived reality, of living in Kingston and studying at Queens and being in Canada. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, that process shaped my research. Mm. Because a very big component, a very big piece of my research today is I'm turning my transcript into poetry.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. And I probably missed that part when I was talking about
That's really cool, yeah.
That's the analysis part mm-hmm. of my research, where I'm turning my transcript into poetry. Mm. So when people read my thesis, instead of expecting a traditional thesis, they'll first be reading poetry. And these poems came all from the transcript. Mm. What would be described as found poems, mm-hmm. right? So the process of doing that, the poetizing of my transcript, which in the literature is called poetic transcription, mm. in the process of doing the poetizing of my transcript today, that process has become possible because I started writing my own experiences in form of poetry some months ago, mm-hmm. some 2 years ago.